The Brain Science Podcast is part of sciencepodcasters.org, the website where you can find high-quality science podcasts from a wide variety of fields. This is episode 63 of the Brain Science Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. Today we are going to be exploring the mysteries of the teenage brain. But first I want to remind you that you can find show notes and episode transcripts at our website at brainsciencepodcast.com. You can also send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. And I have a brand new phone number you can call. It's 206-984-0358. That's 206-984-0358. I will tell you more about that at the end of the show. Today, my guest is David Bainbridge, who teaches veterinary anatomy and reproductive biology at Cambridge University in the UK. He is also the author of 4 popular science books, including Beyond the Zonules of Zen, A Fantastic Journey Through Your Brain, which I talked about back in episode 32. Today, we are going to be talking about his newest book, Teenagers, A Natural History. After the interview, I'll be back with a few announcements, including the details about the new Brain Science Podcast application for the iPhone. David, it's great to have you on the Brain Science Podcast today.
It's great to be here.
Could you start out by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
I've had a fairly mixed career, I suppose. I trained as a veterinary surgeon many years ago, about 20 years ago. And since then, I've worked in practice a little bit. And then I started to research my PhD doing reproductive biology in deer. I then moved across to reproductive biology, especially pregnancy in humans. And I've now ended up being the veterinary anatomist at Cambridge University. Also, about 10 years ago, I started writing popular science books. I've written 4 popular science books, one on pregnancy and reproduction, one on the X chromosome, one on the brain, which I think has featured on the Brain Science Podcast before, and now one on teenagers.
Great. So what percentage of your time do you spend on your writing?
Not as much as I'd like, really. It's just something I do when I'm not doing the day job or the day jobs. I don't know, probably 10 or 15% of my time. Some of these books can take quite a lot of time to get written.
Yeah, and people don't realize that the kinds of books you write is hard to really make any money on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a strange world, publishing. It's the opposite of fiction. It's not too bad getting a contract to get your book published, but then once it's actually published, making money out of it is very difficult.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book. Your last book, Beyond the Zonules of Zen, was about neuroanatomy, as you said. And I can see how, as a veterinary anatomist, an interest in comparative anatomy would lead you to an interest in the human brain. But I'm wondering what led you to write your latest book, Teenagers, A Natural History.
Really, my previous books led me up to writing it. I'd written a book about the brain, I'd written a book about sexuality, and I'd written a book about reproduction. And I started going into the idea of writing the Teenagers book because I thought, well, this is the decade of human life when everything kind of collides. You're doing everything at the same time. You're developing in all sorts of ways, your brain in all sorts of ways. But also, you're being an adult at the same time. But as I actually did more and more research on it, I found it was actually much more interesting than that. It's not just a time when everything collides. In a way, it's the most important time of your life. And I think, really, that's true of the brain as well. There's just so much going on in there.
There's a lot of disagreement about adolescence. Some people even argue that it's just a recent product of modern culture. But your book argues just the opposite. I think on page 14 you say that adolescence is, quote, the essential characteristic of the human race on which our success is built. Could you expand on that idea?
It's really because at the beginning I tried to make a list of what was unusual about people. And obviously many of the things that are unusual about humans as a species are about the brain. Many of the other things are to do with reproduction, and lots of these things really seem to kick in around the teenage years. I mean, it's fairly obvious that people can do a lot more when they're 20 than when they're 10. Obviously, they're pretty clever when they're 10, but they're even more clever by the time that they're 20. And to back that up, there's really two lines of evidence. There's the fossil evidence, and then there's the modern brain scanning evidence. The fossil evidence is that when you actually look back at human fossils, you find that the time when we made our great leap to having the Homo sapiens brain, the sort of 1,300 milliliter brain that we have now, coincided fairly exactly with the time when we first took more than 10 years to mature. So really, teenagers and the big brain appeared at the same time. The modern half of the evidence is, of course, now in the last 10, 15 years, we've been able to brain scan teenagers as they grow up. And you can see this tremendous reconfiguration of this huge human brain in a way that you really don't see in other species. So taken together, all these weird features of humans and when they occur and when they evolved, I came down to my central hypothesis, which really is that without teenagers, we wouldn't be human.
So that's going to surprise a lot of readers, I suspect.
I think it is. But of course, teenagers, because they're making us human, they're letting us do all these amazingly clever things we do. Abstraction, goal-directed planning, incredibly complex use of language, selective language, incredible social feats that they carry out. Because they're doing all that and they're having to learn all that, of course, it's very, very stressful, very demanding, and probably makes you feel pretty grouchy quite a lot of the time. There's just so much reconfiguration going on there. I think it makes life quite difficult for them and also, of course, difficult for anybody who's got to be around them.
Because we're on the Brain Science Podcast, I'm going to focus on the teenage brain, but I want to mention that David's book is actually a very comprehensive look about what it means to be a teenager. So I recommend that you read it to get to the other aspects of the question. But we're going to focus on the brain. Since our bodies undergo extreme changes during adolescence, I guess it makes sense that our brains change also. Can you give us an overview of what happens?
In a way, the brain changes are more surprising than the bodily changes, because the bodily changes are obvious. Everybody knows about them. The brain changes we've only really become aware of since we've been able to do proper brain scans. The most surprising gross change is that the brain actually shrinks. The brain's probably at its largest when you're about 12 or 13. And it actually shrinks after that time. So that, of course, makes 12 and 13-year-olds very happy because they can say they've got bigger brains than their parents. But there's much more to it than just your brain shrinking. It's a much more positive change than that. There's a series of carefully orchestrated and choreographed changes that are going on. The first of these is a process called synaptic pruning. This is where all the connections, the synapses that form in huge profusion in children, they don't completely stop forming, but the rate of formation slows down dramatically. And they're trimmed back or pruned very savagely for a period of about 8 years during the teenage years. And the connections that are being cut away, it's a very selective, organized process. It's not just the connections that aren't used very much. It doesn't seem to be that simple. And also there's waves of pruning sweep across the brain. They do one bit of the brain first, and then they march across to another part of the brain. So that's a very ordered process, but it actually means that the grey matter thins, the grey matter gets thinner, and that's probably the main reason why the brain actually gets smaller. So that's the first big change. The second big change is that many of the pathways lying underneath the grey matter in the white matter, many of those were pre-existing, they were present in childhood, but they weren't myelinated, they didn't have their fatty electrical insulation around them. And there are many tracks deep in the brain, connections deep in the brain, where that myelination, that insulation forms during the teenage years. And one of the effects of this insulation is, strangely enough, for various electrochemical reasons, it actually makes nerves conduct a lot faster. And so we think many of these pathways, although they're there in children, they don't really do much. It's not until they're sort of up to speed and switching on that the brain really starts using them. And so there really are bits of the brains that just weren't used much in childhood that are suddenly switched on. So that's the second big change. Finally, the third big change is that there are certain pathways which have been there all along which seem to start to behave differently. Many of these actually involve dopamine. Dopamine seems to be a neurotransmitter, a chemical that's comes up a lot when you're dealing with teenagers, and dopamine projections from deep in the brain up to the cortex on the surface seem to become more active. That's much harder to study than the sort of anatomical changes, but it is thought to occur as well. So there's a lot going on in there. There's lots of roadworks going on inside the brain. Some of the typical aspects that you see of teenagers may just be that the brain's not working that well because it's in a state of having roadworks. It's like a road. It's not just not working very well because there's a roadblock and there's, you know, men digging up the road. So that may be one of the reasons why teenagers behave the way they do.
So taking the pieces that you just listed one at a time, you talked about the pruning. So in essence, at the beginning, it's almost as if they have too many connections rather than too few.
It is. I mean, it's synaptic pruning, this process of growing in a profusion of connections and then trimming them back. I mean, you actually see this throughout the animal kingdom to some extent. So I'm not claiming that the actual process in itself is unique to humans. But in humans, you see this very dramatic division between the two phases, the proliferation phase in childhood and the trimming back phase in teenage life.
And then I guess when it comes to the myelination and the using parts that we haven't used before, people usually think of the prefrontal lobes as being a big one in this regard.
Yes, that probably is the case. I mean, that's the myelination and also probably the dopamine effect as well. I'll qualify this in a second, but some people have claimed that one of the effects that you see in teenagers is that the way they deal with it with emotion and fear and anger changes, and that they start, instead of using regions deep within the brain, like the amygdala and the so-called limbic system, they start being able to temper their emotion and their anger by using their prefrontal cortex to control it. Of course, the prefrontal cortex does a lot more than that. So that's the idea, is that different bits of the brain are kind of switching on at different times. One thing I should say about all of this is there's one caveat I should add, which I try to do my best in the book to add, because I just never see it written in other books about the teenage brain. We have obviously lots of information about the structural and even the functional changes that are going on in the teenage brain at a sort of low level. We also have lots of anecdotal data, not now psychological data, about how teenagers behave and think. But the thing we don't have, which of course anybody who knows much about the brain will realize, the thing we don't have yet is we don't have the proof that those basic biological changes are actually causing the visible psychological changes we see. Some of them are very, very suggestive, but it's all circumstantial evidence. There's no direct evidence of any of this. And that's something I tried to explain in my book. There are so many books that have come out this saying, teenagers do this because they've got dopamine somewhere. And we just haven't made that link yet. As you can imagine, it's a very difficult link to make.
We're at the level of correlation, but not at the level of proving causation.
I think so, yes. I think that the correlations are very, very good and very, very suggestive, but that's still all they are.
Remembering that correlation does not equal causation is a really big idea that I try to emphasize from time to time, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, it's a very big feature of the teenage brain. I mean, you're starting to read more and more about the teenage brain in the media, and correlation's perfectly good, and you can make policy decisions on things like when you open your schools for teenagers during the day and things like that, but it certainly isn't the same as causation.
Well, what about hormones? Where do they fit in?
The interesting thing about hormones in all of this is they don't really seem to fit in very much. I don't know if you have a phrase like this in America, but people often claim that what teenagers do is because of their raging hormones. But as far as I could tell, the research that I read suggested that very little of teenage behavior is directly driven by hormone levels. That includes sexual behavior and much other behavior as well. Humans in general, compared to many animals, their brain seems quite disconnected from their hormones, surprisingly. And I think this is true of teenagers. I think androgens, male sex hormones, can have a slight effect on behavior. But I think what happens is that many boys, they have so much androgen in their blood that basically they're maxed out on it. And however it varies isn't going to have any effect on them. It may actually be girls who are sort of lower down the dose curve who may actually respond to varying amounts of it. Of course, the one way in which hormones do affect teenagers is the hormones drive the changes in their body. They drive their physical changes. And of course, the teenagers' brains are very, very aware of these physical changes. And so indirectly, the hormones affect behavior. And I think probably that's a more important effect than the direct effect on the brain.
But you made an important point in the book about the fact that love, for instance, is actually mostly mental.
Yes, you hear this cliche that the brain is the human being's most important sexual organ. And it does seem that way when you look at pair bonding and you look at sexual behavior. So much in humans seems to be focused up into the brain. There seems to be relatively little requirement for hormones at all. You do see this in men who have to have their testicles removed for, say, if they have testicular cancer or something like that. The main adverse effect on them seems to be obviously the psychological fact that they've lost the testicles. the hormonal problems seem to be much less. So much in humans seems to be focused up in the brain. Humans have sex for all sorts of reasons, and occasionally it's to have babies, but very often it's not. So they're pretty disconnected from their hormones. I mean, what a ridiculous species. I mean, women don't know when they're fertile. Men don't know when women are fertile. There can't be many species who run the system like that.
And people that have abnormalities where they don't actually go through puberty, their brain still matures, right?
They do. That's the other thing about humans, is there's a tremendous disconnect between puberty and the brain. Puberty seems to be quite variable. I mean, obviously, there's a few people who don't go through it, but in everybody, it's very responsive to things like diet. Puberty's got a lot more recent in the last few hundred years, presumably because diet's improved so much. And yet, the developmental timings of what's going on in the brain don't really seem to be coupled up to that. So it seems to be a fairly independent process. As I say, obviously there's the indirect effect of the fact that puberty would change the physical appearance of the body, which the brain would then be aware of. But they pretty much do seem to be two independent processes. And actually, puberty seems to vary much more in its timing than the development of the brain.
I want to take a moment to mention our sponsor, Audible.com. Audible has over 60,000 titles in all kinds of genres, including psychology and the mind. Today I noticed that Alvin Noué's book, Out of Our Heads, has just been released on Audible. You may recall that I interviewed Dr. Noué this past summer for episode 58. If you are new to Audible, you can download Out of Our Heads or any other title for free by going to audiblepodcast.com/brainscience. I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between the teenage brain and behavior, but before I do, I want to go back to this whole pruning idea. It seems like from the evidence we have that then what we do while we're a teenager is going to have a big effect on what kind of brain we have when we're an adult.
Well, it certainly sculpts the adult brain architecture. The question is, of course, how this correlates with what teenagers are doing all the time. I mean, you see teenagers, they're with their friends all the time, they're socializing. They just look like they're learning things. They look like they're learning social skills, analytical skills, all sorts of skills, linguistic skills. And indeed they are. And presumably the things that they do and the things that they learn, the experiences they have sculpt how they respond to things when they're grown up. Psychologists and psychiatrists are interested in this now. They always used to neglect teenagers, but now they've suddenly got interest in them because they realize this is when we learn many of our behaviors. But again, finding the link between that and the structural changes that go on in every teenage brain, that link just hasn't been made yet. I'm sure it's there. I'm sure there are structural changes imprinted on the teenage brain as it develops in response to what goes on around it. But actually showing that one causes the other is, as you've said before, a much more complicated thing to prove.
So taking into account that most of what we're going to say is based on circumstantial evidence, would you talk a little bit about the relationship between the teenage brain and teenage behavior?
Many of the cliches that you hear about teenage behavior are true, aren't they? One of the ones that's most obvious, and I've certainly seen it my own daughter, who's now 11, she's just started to do this, is they have tremendous trouble getting up in the morning. And certainly in the case of my daughter, it happened very, very suddenly, over a period of about a week. This is a very consistent finding, and it's a good example of how difficult it can be to work in to find out what's actually going on in the brain. Many of the studies of teenage sleep have been related to melatonin, which is a hormone secreted by the pineal gland, which is developmentally forms from the brain. It's on the top of the brain. It's on the top of the diencephalon in the middle of the brain. Weirdly, it doesn't have any direct neural connections with the rest of the brain. It's controlled by a very circuitous route. But melatonin, as many of your listeners will realize, it is secreted at night. So people who've taken melatonin samples and from teenagers and measured them, they've been looking at the shape of the melatonin curve over the course of the day. And they've started to wonder whether teenagers actually lag adults by a couple of hours. And so, you know, when we think it's 8 a.m., they think it's 6 a.m., something like that. Now, the problem with this is melatonin is actually quite an indirect measure of what time the brain thinks it is, because it's not the hormone that tells the brain what time it is. There's a little circuit of cells deep within the hypothalamus in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, it's called. And that almost certainly, there's lots of good evidence for this, actually has a little roughly 24-hour clock ticking away in it, just a little circuit of cells, and they show undulant activity with a time period of 24 hours. Now, of course, actually measuring that in a living human teenager, well, at the moment, it's impossible. But that's the actual clock. That's really the thing which tells them what time they think it is. And so all the studies that have been done on melatonin, they're absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with them. But you just have to bear in mind that it's a very downstream effect of our internal clock. But again, that doesn't stop you basing policy on it. And certainly, I think some schools in the States, and we've just had one do it in the UK as well, have started to open later. The idea being that the teenagers will be slightly more with it, slightly more awake if their school starts and ends later. I think tentative evidence from the States is that the teenagers actually do better. They did actually do some controlled studies in the States, and the performance actually improved when they didn't expect the teenagers to get up quite so early.
I guess one of the behaviors that as an emergency room physician I'm particularly aware of is risk-taking behavior.
Yes, risk-taking behavior is very interesting. I mean, one thing I feel quite strongly about risk, and we talk about teenagers taking risks, I think it's partly because we don't like children taking risks and then suddenly teenagers start taking risks. Risk-taking behavior, of course, is a very important part of human behavior. To succeed in many things, you have to take risks. Most of us would never find a sexual partner if we never took any risks. If you can't risk anything going wrong, then often you don't really achieve very much. And so I don't think risk-taking behavior is one of these things which is just a result of the teenage brain not working properly. I think it is actually something that teenagers are kind of pre-programmed to do. They're pre-programmed to try things. They're pre-programmed to try risky things and see what happens. And I think that the benefits they gain from assessing risk, experiencing risk and experiencing the good things and the bad things that can happen as a result of risk, I think they're very important learning processes. I think probably the problem comes because teenagers were probably pretty good at assessing risks 15,000 years ago. I think teenagers are probably quite good at assessing risks of things like, I don't know, falling out of a tree, getting swept down a river, getting attacked by a lion, I don't know, whatever they were doing, wherever they were living. They're probably not very good at assessing things like driving on wet roads or taking drugs of uncertain potency, unprotected sex when they have no way of telling when somebody has a sexually transmitted disease. I think it's because the risks have changed that the whole thing's going a bit wrong for teenage risk-taking. I don't think it's the teenage brain. I think the teenage brain knew what it was doing, but we changed the risks and it just hasn't been able to cope.
I know sometimes I wish that I could have a little bit of that boldness back.
I think many people do pine after. I mean, many people pine after their teenage years in general. But many of the most successful people you see, they've taken tremendous risks to get to where they are. And I'm sure for each of them, it's been incredibly successful. There's another 10 where it's all gone horribly wrong. But I do think risk is important, and I do think it's vital. But one thing you can see very clearly is not just teenagers, but adults are also very bad at assessing and managing and considering risk in general. So I don't think it's just teenagers. I think they just suddenly fire up the old risk system. The other reason, of course, teenagers take risk is there's a very important psychological process, which is that they have to reject the influence of their parents. And that, of course, makes them want to do things which are seen as bad. And so that's a little additional reason that teenagers take risks as well.
What about the moodiness that so many teenagers seem to have?
Well, they have very, very intense emotions. I mean, my memory of being a teenager is that the good things were really, really good, and the bad things could be really, really bad. It all seemed very intense and immediate and vivid. And this is what many people say anecdotally about their own teenage years. And that often seems to be how teenagers are. I suspect, and quite a lot of the studies suggest this, that what's happening is that, again, early on in the teenage years, you get very good at developing emotional reactions, either good or bad. But the bits of the cortex, especially the frontal cortex, which may sort of feed back and damp down these responses, don't necessarily develop quite so early. So this may be an asynchrony in development of the brain. There are some various theories that are based on things like the social area of the brain develops first, then the emotional area. So you can see the emotional importance of social things happening around you. And then only finally do you develop these cortical areas which feed back and control all these things. And occasionally you do have teenagers who will sort of lash out, make very violent emotional reactions. And then they'll sort of burst into tears or become incredibly embarrassed because they suddenly realize what they've done and that they shouldn't have done it. It's almost like they do have the control valve, but it just doesn't kick in quite quickly enough. So people have started to try and follow these theories up by actually doing, you know, something a bit more practical, looking at brain scans. One of the areas where they've looked at is how teenagers deal with fear, partly because fear is quite a good thing to study because it's quite localized within fairly restricted bits of the brain, which don't seem to do much else. So there's an area called the amygdala, a small almond-shaped bit very deep in the brain, one on either side, which seems to be very involved in reactions to fearful stimuli, but also memory of fearful stimuli, and also even reacting to fearful expressions on other people's faces. It's a very complex structure. It's not just one blob that all does the same thing. There's lots of internal structure inside it. When you actually do functional magnetic resonance imaging on people, when you actually look at blood flow in different areas of the brain, you actually find that different parts of the amygdala and even differences between the left and right react to stimuli different ways at different ages in teenagers, and also as opposed to adults, and they even differ between boys and girls as well. If you take something fairly simple to study, like fear, I said the reason why it's relatively easy because it's quite sort of separated out from most other functions in the brain, you do find that there's real functional changes in there. And of course, fear is very important in our behavior because fear can, well, it can lead to lots of things. It can lead to depression and things like that, but it can also lead to anger. And depression and anger are two things that you often characteristically think of as being teenage things.
Getting back to the dopamine pathways, because they seem to be really important, what do we actually know about how these pathways are changing during adolescence?
Dopamine's a weird transmitter because it's involved in a very weird variety of pathways. The main pathways I'm aware of, and none of those pathways seem to have much to do with each other. One is to do with secretion of milk, which has got nothing to do with what we're talking about. Another is to do with the control of movement, especially in humans, not so much in other animals, and that's the one that's involved in Parkinson's disease. So again, that's not really what we're talking about now. But there's two pathways which do seem to be important in teenagers. One is these projections up to the cortex, which seem to moderate and modulate activity, especially frontal cortex processes. And the other pathway, again, nothing to do with the other three, is the so-called addiction pathway to do with the septal nuclei. And it's basically the pathway which we think is the major common central pathway related to probably to addiction, however you define that. Of course, that's quite a complicated issue. So really, if we ignore the Parkinson's and the milk secretion, it's really the dopamine projections up to the forebrain and the so-called addiction-related pathways, which we're particularly interested in. The dopamine projection pathways up to the forebrain, they're quite difficult to study because if things are big enough to study on brain scans, if they're within the resolution of a modern MRI scan, then obviously that suddenly makes them very easy to study. If they're not, it makes them a lot harder, and you tend to be looking at things like post-mortem studies, which can be, well, you just don't get much material. You don't get much material for teenagers full stop, luckily, because hopefully most of them don't end up in the post-mortem room. The addiction pathway, again, very deep in the brain, very difficult to study in real time. Really there, the information we have about the dopamine pathway of addiction is, again, really different patterns of stimulus response, looking at how easy or how difficult it is for teenagers to get addicted to different substances, how easy or difficult it is for them to then, kick that addiction, and to actually look at some of the differing biological effects of various addictive substances on the brain and the body. So there's four dopamine pathways, two not really relevant and two apparently very relevant. But because these are sort of below the range of discrimination of imaging techniques, we still have to be quite cautious about what we know about these.
What about what you wrote in the book about the difference between the tegmentum accumbens pathway and the tegmentum accumbens cortical pathway? Is that evidence more solid?
It is solid, but again, it suffers from the same problems. We think the one pathway, the pathway going to the cortex, gradually seems to predominate over the one going to the accumbens, the sort of basic drive pathway. Most of the evidence points in that direction. It doesn't necessarily mean that evidence is complete. And again, as I keep saying, it's important to emphasize whether lots of the evidence seems to fit together, but it doesn't mean that all the links have been made.
But what are the implications of that particular evidence?
One implication is that addiction is a very complicated process, and it's probably a process that you in your line of work may know more about than me. There are various aspects to addiction, but there does seem to be this pathway involving the nucleus accumbens in the septal region of the brain. It's a very important pathway, which is why we have it. It's a pathway which appears to program us to seek out things which we have previously enjoyed. In itself, it may not be directly involved in enjoyment, but it's a sort of spin-off. It directs us to seek out the things we've enjoyed in the past, which is obviously quite important if those things are food or drink or shelter or sex or things like that. And this seems to be the pathway into which drugs tap. They kind of sort of push themselves up your list of priorities. As soon as you take something like cocaine, it edges its way up, it superactivates this pathway, releases lots of dopamine in this pathway, and that makes you want more.
Now, is the tegmentin accumbens pathway the same pathway as the one that they think is related to addiction?
Yes, it is, yes. And it's involved in, as I say, finding all these things that you've enjoyed before. But addiction is more complicated than just a simple drive to find the same thing again and again. Of course, you could say that's the basis of what it is. But you do have conscious control over addiction. We know you have conscious control over addiction because people think, I don't want to be addicted to whatever drug it is, and they give it up. This is the cortical pathway, the projections up to the cortex, and cortical activity that allow you to make that conscious decision and to fight this inner urge to take whatever drug you want. And the possibility is, of course, in teenagers that if the accumbens pathway has developed earlier before the projections that activate the cortex, the idea is that it then makes it harder for them to quit whatever drug they're on. And there is quite a bit of evidence that teenagers seem to find it harder to quit nicotine. Lots of the best data seems to come from nicotine. It may be true of things like cocaine and alcohol as well, but certainly with nicotine, there's quite good evidence that teenagers just do seem to find it harder to give up nicotine than adults do. And maybe this is because there's less of this sort of cortical control from above, tempering the accumbens pathway below.
Now, if we leave out the problem of addiction, would the significance of the accumbens cortical pathway over the old tegmentum, just the accumbens pathway, mean that we would be able to go from being sort of driven by really basic things, emotional drives, to being able to become driven or rewarded by more mental goals or whatever?
I think it probably is part of this whole process. I mean, there used to be this old tradition that they'd say that there's this reptile brain deep inside us, and then built on top of that was the mammalian brain, and built on top of that was the human brain. But actually, most brains have all the same parts in them. Lots of the things that are called neo or new, they're actually present in fish and reptiles. It's just not the bits they particularly use. The thing you do see in humans is this gradual transfer of certain bits of the brain start to predominate and become more important, especially towards the end of the teenage years. And the late teenage years are the triumph of the neocortex, where all this tremendous drive to socialize and analyze and self-analyze suddenly seems to come good. Kids often seem to come good at about sort of 17 or 18 or 19. And suddenly seem sort of articulate adult people. It's almost as if they've come out of nowhere. I think that's sort of where the teenage story ends, where suddenly it all comes good. And not much really seems to happen after that. Girls aren't growing anymore at that age. Boys are just about to stop growing. And yet, right, there's the brain. That's really how it's going to be. And in just a few years, the brain's kind of sculpted itself, and especially the way the cortex controls the inner workings of the deeper parts of the brain, near the center of the brain. That, in a way, is a big part of, I think, what's going on in the teenage brain.
So how does the way that teenagers think change during this period?
The anecdotal evidence, I mean, there's quite a lot of psychological studies of how teenagers think and what they do. There are various things that happen. They start to think about themselves less. In the early teenage years, there's quite a lot of almost obsessive introspection which goes on, probably more in girls than boys, but it's a feature of both sexes. And that gradually wanes as they get older to what we probably start thinking of as a more sensible, more moderate adult level. Goal-directed learning just continues to become more and more complex. They do the thing which children can't do is they're not very good at planning. You know, I want to be doing so-and-so in 5 years' time, so I've got to do this and this and this. And that just gets better and better. And it may well continue developing into adulthood as well. But by the time you get to 18 or 19, you're really starting to think quite a long way into the future. Also, the way humans think socially changes a lot towards the end of the teenage years. The early teenage years are characterized by a real sort of obsessive need to, A, push yourself away from your parents and interact with people of your own age, to have friends, of course, that thing which seems pretty unique to humans to me. And that tendency moderates later in the teenage years. So it's very clear that teenagers, they stop being nicer to their parents, and, you know, they still have friends. But their friends are, they're kind of different, and it's being moderated more by things like romance and sex. That starts to take up more of their time. And so I suppose you could say that their sort of social world goes back to being more balanced rather than just being completely friend-obsessed as it is early on. So there are a few things that you can measure very specifically, like a working memory, how many concepts people can maintain in their brain at any one time. And there are some fairly sort of mathematical, psychological tests which do this. And you find that the number of things people can hold basically in the front of their mind increases pretty steadily throughout the teenage years. And of course, being able to think about lots of different things at the same time, I mean, that's what leads to lateral thinking and comparing things and even creativity. Often creativity is bringing together two things that really wouldn't make sense to be brought together when you're 10, but when you're 20, you suddenly think, well, you put those two together and you suddenly get a new interesting juxtaposition. So these seem to be the ways that the teenage brain is changing the way it thinks. But as you can tell from all the things I've been saying, these are really psychological findings. They're not sort of basic neuroscience findings. And so, again, we have this gap between the basic neuroscience and the measured psychological changes that we observe.
Even before we started into this current, hopefully golden age of neuroscience, we had a lot of psychological information. I can remember the first time I heard about the difference between concrete reasoning and abstract reasoning. And, you know, you look around and you go, huh, there's an awful lot of adults who never make it to abstract reasoning.
Yeah, that's one thing that always worried me about psychology is that they love having stages. They love having stages that people go through. And I think people are more complicated than that. I think some people get good at certain things. I mean, some people are never any good at maths. But it doesn't mean they're stupid people. It just means they're useless at math. They may be wonderful at something else. Yeah, that would be a big problem with psychologists. They do like staging human life in a way that I'm not sure really. I think it's a bit more continuous, the change, than that.
What about language skills? I mean, we obviously learn most of our language before we reach adolescence.
This is a very interesting divide because you're right. We seem to learn lots of our language by adolescence. And if by language you mean pronunciation, vocabulary, grammar, syntax, and that's absolutely right. You're pretty good at talking by the time you're 10 or 11. And if you're not, then it's probably a bit too late to do very much about it. But that's really only the first part. Human language is a wonderful thing because there's that half of it, and that half in itself, of course, is impressive enough. But because I was writing about teenagers, I had to make out that the teenage side of it was more interesting. The thing teenagers start to do is they start to put their language into a social context. And there's various parts of this. One thing is, first of all, whenever they're going to say something, they think about how the other person is going to react. It's called mentalizing. It's making mental models of what's going on inside other people's heads. Because we all do it all the time, we don't really think about it very much. But of course, actually, it's an incredibly, fabulously complex and interesting thing for us to be able to do, to project ourselves inside other people's brains, make assumptions about how they work, and think before we speak to people. The result of this is that teenagers do this thing which children don't. We love children because they're very naive and they'll talk to everybody in the same way, whether it's, I don't know, the Queen of England or their friend at school or their teacher. They talk to them all the same. Teenagers very obviously stop doing that. They start talking to different people in different ways. Very characteristically, for example, they monosyllabic grunt at their parents. It's a thing which often seems to happen here. It probably happens in America as well. They can be quite articulate and charming with other adults if they want to be. So it's not as if they've lost the ability to speak. And then the most spectacular is the linguistic changes involved in communicating with other teenagers. When teenagers get in groups, the language they use is, I would say, it's probably the most complicated and clever language that they'll use all their life because it's ultra-social language. The idea is it's language to create little social groups, little exclusive social groups into which children, adults and some other teenagers cannot get access simply because they cannot understand the language. So the language is slang and idioms and in-jokes and deliberate humorous provocation in a very complex way, which is pretty much incomprehensible to adults, which I think often makes adults quite cross, but you know, that's just life. It is meant to be there to exclude adults. And, of course, teenage language just gets more and more complicated. Teenagers, they don't just have one social group. They can have more than one, and they'll use different forms of language with different groups. And then, of course, at the end, we have the superimposition of what I think is the most wonderful form of human communication, which is they have to learn how to flirt as well. Now, if ever there was a complex form of language, it's flirting, a form of language where you're communicating with somebody, but it's very unclear whether they're supposed to know the message that you're actually trying to convey. Or are you trying to convey it? And do you want them to know? And how much do you want them to know? And I think teenage flirting, I mean, it goes on for so long, it's far more complicated than adult flirting. I think adults tend to be a bit more direct. And so the language changes are very dramatic. It's not the grammar. Well, there's a little bit of extra grammar, a little bit of extra vocabulary you learn when you're a teenager. But I wouldn't expect it would probably be more than 10 or 20%. The real change is the context, the social context in which you communicate. Because we all learn to do it, we all just take it for granted. You talk to different people in different ways, and you do that because you learned to when you're a teenager.
That's a good point. It sounds to me like teenage language is perhaps an under-researched area, but then I think you make the point that really basically teenagers are under-researched. Or have been.
I think they have been. I think things have improved in the last 10 years. I mean, the ability to brain scan has been a huge boon because you can take one individual and repeatedly look in their brain for 10 years if you want to. Psychologists have suddenly got interested in them at last. People who've developed social policy have become interested in them as far as, why do they become involved in crime? Why do they become involved in addictive substances and things like that? When I was writing this book, so much of what was in it had really just come out in the last 10 years. It was very striking.
From a cognitive standpoint, is there anything that teenagers do poorly that sticks out in your mind?
I think the ability to hold lots of things in their mind at any one time, the working memory, that did quite impress me, partly because it's a very sort of objective, tangible test which you can use on humans and measure how many things they can hold in their, kind of in their mind at any one time. And you can measure it increasing. Of course, in teenagers, because of the way their brains work, they're sort of, almost sort of free running. They don't have many inhibitions. They don't make many assumptions because they haven't got much experience to base them on. They can hold all these things in their heads and put them together in all these weird orders. And many of the great human flights of creativity that have really made the difference to us, I think they've often been based on ideas which people have had when they were teenagers. I don't think they could necessarily exploit them fully when they were teenagers because they didn't have enough experience or skill yet. People like Einstein, many writers, many artists, although they didn't necessarily produce the work when they were teenagers, they would often hark back to ideas or thoughts that they'd had when they were teenagers. So the teenage creativity, I think, is very important, even though they often don't seem to be able to do anything tangible with it.
Do they have trouble with interpreting the emotions of non-teenagers?
I don't actually know. I haven't really looked into that. I think to a great extent, they're not very interested. So I don't know if it would necessarily worry them. But I don't know if they find it harder to interpret it. I think they're very good with each other. I just don't know if they really focus on other people very much.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time. But I want to ask you, first of all, do you have any specific advice for parents?
I think it's with many things that you find difficult with life. Teenage behavior, they all do it. You just have to accept it. I think the thing that the brain and the evolutionary story tells us is that adults may have been put on earth to make life easier for teenagers, but the opposite is not necessarily true.
Okay. What about specific advice for teenagers?
Again, teenagers, they can be great, they can be awful. They are just very vivid. Despite what other teenagers may say, everybody is going through the same basic process. Try and make your own decisions as much as you can.
And I think you also, we won't have time to get into this, you made a good case for putting off experimenting with things like drugs and alcohol.
Yes, I mean, I was very liberal about this before I started writing the book, but the more I looked at the evidence, especially with the very potent drugs that are available nowadays, it just worried me what the possible effects could be of substances like that hitting the brain in this very sensitive developmental phase. Like I say, I was very liberal about drugs before I wrote this book, but I just do wonder if it might be best waiting to try those things until you're a little bit older.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we close?
I think that's pretty much it, really. Because I don't really want to, like you say, move over into the non-brain stuff, because that's a whole other kettle of fish, really.
Do you see teenagers as being a potential audience for your book?
We discussed this when we were first pitching the book. It would have been lovely to write the book expressly for teenagers, but my publisher, very sensibly, I think, pointed out that most of these sorts of books are bought by adults. I have had quite a lot of feedback from teenagers whose parents have bought the book and they've then gone on to read it. Most of the feedback has actually just been saying it's nice that somebody's written a book that's quite nice about teenagers for a change, rather than just complaining about all these awful things they do. I don't know what it's like in the States, but the media over here is just full of bad things that teenagers are doing. They never talk about any of the good things.
I think it's pretty similar here.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
I was wondering, because I couldn't figure out after reading the book whether it was, I don't have any of my own kids, but I have teenage nieces and nephews, and kind of figuring out whether or not they would actually read such a book. It's hard to tell.
I think really it would be later teenagers who'd read it in general. I've had a few early and mid-teen. My daughter started reading it. She's read snippets of it. She's only 11, so obviously she had to jump over a few bits. But I think she quite liked it. I mean, I think she was just reading it to find out what the hell's going to happen to her.
Yes, and for those of you out there who are teenagers, this book answers the question, do girls really mature faster than boys?
Yeah, that's the all one, especially when you're a 13-year-old boy, as far as I can remember anyway.
But you have to read the book to find out the answer. Well, David, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I want to also thank you for writing Beyond the Zanyas of Zen and sharing your images from your book from that. That's one of the episodes that people either love or hate, depending on where they're coming from. But I've gotten some good feedback from it, and I think it's a great book, and I've had a lot of people tell me that they bought it, so I hope that helps a little.
Yes, I've certainly had quite a lot of feedback from people who've read the book via listening to your podcast, so I know it's the right audience for me.
Well, great. I'll let you know, David, as soon as this show goes up online.
That'll be great.
Okay, thanks a lot for being on the show.
I've really enjoyed it.
I want to thank David Bainbridge for coming on the Brain Science Podcast, and I also want to thank listener Jeff King for helping to edit this episode. I highly recommend David's books, especially Teenagers, A Natural History, and Beyond the Zanyas of Zen, which is the one that I covered back in episode 32. I also want to take a moment to thank those of you who are helping to support the Brain Science Podcast with your donations. If you are interested in learning how you can help support my work, just go to brainsciencepodcast.com and click on the tab at the top of the page labeled Donations and Subscriptions. Remember that every little bit helps. Even if you can't afford to contribute money, you can still help promote the show by sharing it with others. Before I get into today's announcements, I just want to remind you to visit the website brainsciencepodcast.com. There you will find show notes, links to David's website, and even a transcript of today's episode. I would love to hear your feedback. You can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com or join the discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. And don't forget the brand new phone-in line, 206-984-0358. That's 206-984-0358. This line uses a free answering service called K7. When you call this line, it will record your message and send it to me as an audio file. Unless you indicate otherwise, I will assume that you are giving me permission to use this audio on a future show. If you are on Facebook, don't forget to join the Brain Science Podcast fan page. You can find it by searching for Brain Science Podcast inside Facebook. Just be sure you join the fan page and not the old Brain Science Podcast group. If there's anyone out there that can help me get dedicated usernames for my fan pages, just drop me an email at docartemis@gmail.com or send me a message via Facebook. Finally, don't forget that since the Brain Science Podcast does not advertise, I rely on you to leave reviews on iTunes and mention it in your blogs or Twitters. And don't forget to subscribe so that you'll get every episode. You'll find all the subscription options at brainsciencepodcast.com. Starting this month, the Brain Science Podcast is coming out on the second Wednesday of each month, and Books and Ideas will be coming out on the fourth Wednesday, though I might bring out Books and Ideas a couple of days early in November and December to avoid Thanksgiving and Christmas. The current Books and Ideas is from the live show that I did at this year's Dragon Con in Atlanta. Les Johnson from NASA was a wonderful guest. You can find that at booksandideas.com. The November episode of Books and Ideas will be an interview with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And that will be out before the end of November. The December episode of the Brain Science Podcast will be our annual review episode. And I also have a special episode planned in December for Books and Ideas. I'm going to end by telling you a little bit about the new Brain Science Podcast application, which is now available in the iTunes App Store. I have saved this for the end so that those of you who don't have an iPhone or iPod Touch can fast forward to the end. I've already gotten messages from people asking me about whether or not this application is available on other platforms like the BlackBerry and the Zune. But at the present time, this is an iPhone, iPod Touch only application. First, I want to thank Wizard Media for creating this application. While I have done a lot of work to make sure that you can get extra content, like episode transcripts, delivered directly to your phone or touch, I would never have been able to find the time to create this application from scratch, or even the time to learn how to write an application. The price is $4.99 in U.S. dollars. This is split between Apple, Wizard, and me. But why would you want to buy this application? First of all, it allows you to listen to any episode of the Brain Science Podcast without downloading it to your phone. In other words, you will be streaming it. You can also read the episode transcripts directly on your phone. Another neat feature is that there are buttons that make it easy for you to send me feedback via email or the new phone line, or to just go straight to the website if you want to check out a link. I have tested all these features, but I hope you will let me know what you think. One thing I noticed was that the streaming works great with Wi-Fi, but not so great on 3G. My experience with other streaming apps has been that they also don't work very well with Edge. Obviously, if you're going on a long trip where you may not have a consistent signal, you will want to download the episodes via iTunes. I don't really see this application taking the place of iTunes, but it will be useful when you're away from your computer, since it allows you to get around the fact that iTunes won't let you download podcasts over the network if they're over 10 meg, and the average Brain Science podcast is over 20. There's one other feature that's kind of cool called Background Play. You'll find that under Episode Extras. This allows you to continue listening even if you leave the app, so that you can do things like answer your email or even your phone. This feature has a few interesting little quirks that I think you'll enjoy exploring. I don't expect to make a lot of money from this application, but I am hoping that it will generate some visibility for the show. That's why I'm trying to encourage as many people as possible to buy the app during the week of November 9th through 15th. Then next week I will be promoting a similar app for Books and Ideas. I hope you'll check it out, even if you miss the official launch week. And be sure to leave a review on iTunes, and I will keep you posted when new features are added. That's it for this month. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2009, Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.